Thank goodness, yes. Now, this is the sort of thing that happens. A typical programme on the day. Off they go, a lady in waiting and a private secretary, an equerry, the police officer and Her Majesty. The Queen will have chosen her clothes to suit the occasion. Always a small hat, almost brimless, because people want to see her, you know, not an obscuring picture hat. They get to the station. The mayor, the town clerk and the others are there waiting to greet them. And if the reception committee are new to royal visits, they'd probably be absolutely astonished that the Queen knows all their names. And then out to the station yard, a guard of honour to be inspected, whatever the weather, and then off to the town hall through the tremendous cheers dinning in the ears all the time, and then into the council chamber. Well, of course, it's quieter there, but there are hundreds of people lined up to be presented one by one. Handshakes, handshakes. There may be over 1,000 hands to be shaken in this one day. It's really enough to give you a sprained arm. Well, then, outside again, it's fine now, because they're away to a sports ground for a children's rally. More tremendous screaming noise as the Queen goes round the field, smiling, standing up in that field car, perfectly at ease and perfectly poised the whole time as she drives round. And always attentive. Remember, every second is someone's special minute of seeing the Queen on that one day, never relaxing for one minute. And then, say, a hospital visit. Now, the Queen's seen hundreds and hundreds of hospital, but this mustn't seem so. This is the day of a lifetime for this town and this hospital, and what the Queen did yesterday, what she's going to do tomorrow, it doesn't matter. This is their one day that matters. Then there's a lunch in the Municipal Hall, inspecting an art gallery perhaps on the way, more presentation lines, more handshakes, a lunch, probably a simple menu with just three courses, the Queen will have asked for that, a speech at the lunch, and then the afternoon's engagements. A visit to a factory, more noise, more crowds, more interest, and then off again, in and out of the car. A school, perhaps, to be visited, with an unsparing close-up of absolutely everything, from the girls learning laundry work to the Queen watching boys in the biology lab dissecting frogs. And so through the whole programme to the end, and maybe a 10-hour day will have been put in by the time Buckingham Palace is reached. And all the time, the Queen's been the focus of attention, caught in the searchlight, held under a microscope, as it were.
If there is one outstanding quality demanded of the Queen in her job, it is the supreme gift of tact and diplomacy. Now, just imagine the delicate responsibilities of being the world's greatest international hostess, entertaining a remarkably varied stream of distinguished visitors, ranging from President Kennedy to Mr. Khrushchev. Our diplomatic correspondent, Thomas Barman, told me what this involves.
Well, let's say it at once. It involves an enormous amount of preparation. I look at the range of visitors that turn up, not just visitors from the old Commonwealth that we're used to, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and so on, but the new Commonwealth, people of different races, different languages, different habits, and then from different countries, ranging all the way from President Eisenhower and President Kennedy at one extreme, so to speak, to Mr. Khrushchev and Mr. Bulganin, we must remember him, at the other. And it involves, if you're going to put these people at their ease, it involves knowing a great deal about them, about their countries, about the political situation of the day, so that you can talk to them about official subjects that interest them and personal subjects that interest them. When the German president was here, not so very long ago, the Queen arranged a special exhibition of Holbein pictures because she knew her guest was interested in them.
The Queen is, in fact, the official hostess for the nation, isn't she?
Well, that's the root of the problem, isn't it, being the official hostess. A private hostess is one thing. An official hostess means that on all the controversial subjects of the day, she has got to have the official opinion of the nation. And the official opinion of the nation at any given time is the opinion of the government of the day as approved by the Houses of Parliament. Rather on the analogy of the Queen's speech. When the Queen reads her speech to the Houses of Parliament, she's not expressing a personal view, she's expressing the view of the government of the day, and that's what's got to be done. And this is what also needs a great deal of tact. You can mix your conversation with this official stuff and your private stuff, your personal stuff, but you mustn't give away things that are regarded by the government of the day as secrets.
But apart from those sort of considerations, it always appears to me from the pictures I've seen that these state visits at Buckingham Palace, they're splendid, spectacular occasions.
They're absolutely splendid. But of course, the danger is that in this splendour, the formality will take over completely, and there'll be no informality at all, and people really won't feel at their ease. Why, even when you've got people with foreign languages that are not commonly spoken, Russian, you have to speak to them through interpreters. And that, of course, takes away a lot of the informality. So that the problem is, how can you keep this informal while at the same time preserving the formal thing? And that's the essence of this particular job as a hostess, in addition to the other one I've mentioned, is to make people feel at ease because you mix a lot of informality, as much as you can, with the formality of the occasion. And that is what makes a good hostess, which we all know the Queen is.
Well, how was the Queen trained for all these many tasks? Miss Laird outlined for me the special studies the Queen had to undertake, even as a girl.
Well, of course, she had all the ordinary basic education. She had education in a special French teacher. But in addition, she had constitutional history to study. And that she did with Sir Henry Martin, who was then Vice Provost of Eton. She used to go to him at Eton twice a week. And there, of course, she learnt from Badgett and from all the constitutional histories. And it was what would affect her in the future, her own relationship with her own country and with the Commonwealth. And after the war, then she had a real course in practical civics. She went to Parliament, to magistrates' courts, to ordinary courts, so all the institutions which are carried on in her name for herself. Of course, she learned a great deal from her father, who discussed and showed her much of what he did. She met a great many people from the Commonwealth, and eventually, of course, she began to travel herself.
The fruits of all that work have been seen on many occasions since the Queen came to the throne. But long before that, she had a very deep appreciation of her future responsibilities. Let's recall for a moment the broadcast she made on her 21st birthday in 1947, when she was with her parents in South Africa, and particularly the dedication passage in that speech.
I declare before you all that my whole life, whether it be long or short, shall be devoted to your service and the service of our great imperial family to which we all belong. But I shall not have the strength to carry out this resolution alone unless you join in it with me, as I now invite you to do. I know that your support will be unfailingly given. God help me to make good my vow, and God bless all of you who are willing to share in it.
Now, for most of us, the Queen is bound to be a rather remote figure. Brief glimpses of her driving through the streets of a provincial town, or on her way to open Parliament or to Guildhall, and all the photographs we see of her in the papers, all this is too fragmentary to see her as an individual with a personality of her own. But there are people who have the opportunity of seeing the Queen as very, very few of her millions of subjects will ever see her. I've been talking to Edward Halliday, who's painted several portraits of the Queen. I'd remarked to him that as an artist, he must quite literally see the Queen from an entirely different viewpoint.
Well, it is true that I've spent many hours with the Queen. The first impression one gets is, of course, of her lovely colouring. She has the most delicate skin, and her eyes, which are a sort of bluey purple, I would not be able exactly to describe them. They're quite wonderful. I happen to think that she is very, very beautiful. I also know that her beauty doesn't only consist of her looks. It's her sparkling personality, her gaiety, that makes her, to my mind, the unique person she is.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the famous family resemblance?
Well, when I painted the Queen first in 1948, when she was Princess Elizabeth, she was then a young woman just emerging from girlhood, young, lovely, and dedicated. But now, of course, after 14 years, she has developed into something rather different. She's now a woman whose character shows in the refining of her features. Sometimes she has a distinct look of her father.
Mm-hmm. Now, apart from portraits which show the Queen in on more formal occasions, when she's wearing evening dress with the robes of some order, you have, of course, painted the Queen on more informal occasions, like in a family setting, haven't you?
Yes, I had the great privilege of painting a conversation piece at Clarence House just after she had become Queen. And I painted a family group. The Queen in just a simple black frock, sitting on a sofa with her arm round Prince Charles, reading to him. Duke of Edinburgh sitting by the fire with the corgis at his feet, and Princess Anne playing with her toys on the floor. This was a record, really, a private record for them, yes, of their very happy life at Clarence House before she had to move to Buckingham Palace.
Now tell me, Mr. Halliday, is the Queen a patient sitter?
Oh, yes. She's always completely relaxed, and she's always very helpful. She'll always cooperate with the artist in how you want her to sit and that sort of thing.
And what do? Do you chat or do you work in silence?
Oh, no. As I've described her as being a gay person, she talks a great deal, which makes the sittings most enjoyable. And sometimes, of course, she's talking and one has to say, "I'm sorry, ma'am, will you please keep still? I'm painting your nose."
Looking back over the past 10 years, possibly one of the more significant features of the Queen's reign has been the way in which two things have developed side by side. The growing emphasis on the importance of guidance for youth, and the fact that the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh have their own young family. Inevitably, their three children will be called upon eventually to carry some of the royal burden. For Prince Charles, the duty is inescapable. But it was refreshingly in keeping with the times that one announcement about Prince Charles was sprung as a complete surprise by the Queen in her own recorded voice that memorable Saturday afternoon in Cardiff at the end of the Empire Games in 1958.
The British Empire and Commonwealth Games in the capital, together with all the activities of the Festival of Wales, have made this a memorable year for the Principality. I have therefore decided to mark it further by an act which will, I hope, give as much pleasure to all Welshmen as it does to me. I intend to create my son Charles, Prince of Wales, today.
That was the monarchy in touch with the people, an imaginative gesture with all the appeal of youth and tradition. Well, we have a Prince of Wales who's obviously not going to lead the sort of sheltered, artificial life which in the past has chained and inhibited so many heirs to the throne. Moreover, he'll grow up with a generation very much in tune with the new world, a development in which his father has played no small part through schemes such as the Duke of Edinburgh's award for the encouragement of initiative and endurance by young people. For an appreciation of the value of this work, I turn to the man who directs this scheme, Sir John Hunt of Everest fame. I asked him if the Duke had felt that young people needed the sort of leadership which the Duke's generation, only a few years between them, could provide.
He's always given me the impression of believing that there should be and can be a very close link between people of no matter what age, and particularly between older people and people still in their teens, and provided that the kind of leadership is right and the attitude is not a patronising one.
Now, and you see this working out in practice?
Well, indeed I do. I mean, I go about with him quite a lot in connection with the award scheme, and it's a very thrilling experience to see him with young people and to see what a common note, so to speak, is struck between them from the start. Both the Duke of Edinburgh himself and whatever young people he's with, no matter where they're from, are completely at their ease from the start. They can talk to each other completely freely, and that seems to me to be a remarkable gift on the part of Prince Philip. I'm sure that one of the reasons which makes it easy for him to understand the problems and brings the problem home to him is that, in fact, he is a family man himself.
Historians of the future will apportion the influence of the Duke of Edinburgh in bringing the monarchy more into line with the times. What can be said now, and without dispute, is that comparatively few men in this country can have a keener awareness or a greater appreciation of all the scientific and technological developments which have marked these 10 years, years which have taken us into the space age. Sir Harold Hartley, who was formerly president of the World Power Conference, has been very closely associated with the Duke in many of his scientific interests. Now, Sir Harold told me how the Duke prepared his first major speech as president of the British Association while he was commanding HMS Magpie in the Mediterranean. The Duke reviewed the progress of science and technology over the past 100 years.
It was a bold choice for a young man. He kept us busy, sending him books and memoranda, and he wrote his address in the paper-strewn cabin of Magpie, some of it on the signal pads of the ship. It was a brilliant success, beautifully delivered, and he learnt a lot from the hard work he'd put in. A year later, his active service in the Navy ended with the Queen's accession. But he quickly found work to his hand in his Commonwealth tours and his growing interest in industry and education. Last year, he gave another brilliant lecture to 2,000 engineers on their contribution to Commonwealth development. Based on his experience on his tours, it was a fine tribute to the achievements of engineering. And it also contained some severe criticisms of the shortcomings he'd noticed, typical of Prince Philip's habit of speaking his mind. The lecture was actually written while he was with the Queen on her strenuous tour in the East last year. It was an amazing feat, made possible by the fine quality of Prince Philip's mind and his ability to concentrate. It showed, too, his quick grasp of the essentials of any problem and his power of observation. Nothing escapes him, and he often steps off the red carpet to investigate something he's noticed. He's a very direct approach. He makes touch quickly with anyone to whom he's speaking. They feel at once his human interest in whatever they are doing. His outlook is always constructive, and his Commonwealth Technical Training Week, entirely his own idea, shows what a keen eye he has for the deficiencies in our present system.
Well, these have been 10 momentous testing years for the monarchy, an institution which doesn't escape its share of criticism. There'll always be people who say that it's too remote from the realities of life, that it ought to shed some of the decorative trimmings. But in a number of ways, that is what has been happening. Some of the more highly publicized frills have gone, including the old-fashioned presentation parties for Debs. They're out. On the other hand, as evidence of a widening range of interests, there are those small luncheon parties at the palace, where the Queen's guests have included people with widely differing backgrounds. On one occasion, for example, a famous pianist, a woman police officer, a Labour Member of Parliament, the boss of an engineering works, and a journalist. Well, this is all part of something which is changing, yet changeless. The practice of kingship, which can never be divorced from the person and the personality of the monarch. The year after her father's death, Queen Elizabeth was crowned in Westminster Abbey. We've invited the man who, as Archbishop of Canterbury, anointed and crowned the Queen to close this anniversary portrait, Lord Fisher of Lambeth.
I suppose every amateur gardener occasionally feels the desire to pull up a plant to see how its roots are doing. A wise one never does that. It is one of the restless features of today's public life that commentators are always pulling up tender and gracious plants by the roots to see how they're getting on. But perhaps there are a few things I can usefully say at the end of this program. What everyone wants to know about a public person is whether he is two persons, one in public and a different one in private. Obviously, it would not always be fitting to behave in the same way out of doors and indoors, but is he the same honest person? General opinion generally guesses right. I would say from such experiences as I've had that the Queen is splendidly the same honest, frank, sensible, sympathetic, religious person in private as in public. She never acts a part. She fulfills many parts, but always, not only as Queen, but as herself. That is what is so refreshing and stimulating about her. She enjoys people and all human situations, but with the saving grace of not always being amused by them. She has her own frank opinions, which are based on knowledge and good judgment and are vigorously held. I've never, so far as I can recall, heard her comment on the endless gossip about the personal affairs of the royal family, which some papers and books indulge in. That shows with what restraint, as well as with what wisdom, she sees life steadily and sees it whole, and it indicates one kind of burden laid on her to a degree neither necessary nor respectful. It was my humble duty to be the chief minister of the Queen's anointing and coronation. The nation was deeply moved by the spiritual significance of that great ceremony and was uplifted by it to a sense that this was a dedication of the nation as well as of the Queen. The Queen was profoundly and deeply moved by that same service and has never departed from the sense of her dedication and the grace which it gives. If the nation has forgotten to think much or often about its dedication, at least let it never cease to thank God for her dedication to her ministry among us.
Anniversary Portrait, produced by the BBC's Radio Newsreel production team, was narrated by Robert Reed.